Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. On today's podcast, I'm going to be trying to answer the question, what does it mean to be human? And to help me answer this question is author and journalist Will Storr, who's done quite a bit on this subject. He's been on the podcast before, done a fantastic podcast, which we repeated twice because we loved it so much, about his book Selfie. And the reaction to that has been phenomenal, by the way. The reason I'm discussing this is I've struggled during lockdown. I've discussed this on Sunday brunch. The reaction has been absolutely huge. And it got me thinking about what my problems were. And I think my problems were, I'm not sure what it is to be human anymore. But anyway, let's discuss this with Will. Hi, Will. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Tim. How are you doing?
Well, yeah, I'm all right. I'm frustrated because someone told me we've gone into the fifth month of lockdown. I'm not sure that. Are we in the fourth? We must be in the fourth.
Yeah, no, it's got to be four, surely.
So when did we start? We started in March, didn't we?
March, April, yeah. May, June, July. Yeah, four. We're in four.
And we're doing this in July. So we're in the fourth month of lockdown. How are you anyway? How are you finding it productive?
Yeah, too productive. You know, like I'm writing my next book, and I've just sort of been forced into this kind of almost like a monk-like form of working, where it's just bed, write, bed, write, bed, write, like they probably did in the medieval times. And it's kind of missing getting out there, having meetings, missing my Starbucks.
So, yeah,
it's getting a bit intense now. Month four, I'm just beginning to feel like a bit like a robot.
Yeah, when I wake up every morning, I think, oh God, again. It's really starting to get to me in that way.
Yeah.
What are you working on at the moment? Can you let us know?
Yeah, my next book, which is due out next year, if I get it finished in time, in April, and it's about status. It's about kind of the importance of status to people.
Why do you find these subjects so interesting? I mean, the book, the podcast you did with me on the book Selfie, I love that book, by the way. It's really changed the way I think about life and the reality that humans aren't even the same in pretty much in the same continent, let alone in the same different parts of the world. We're very different in the way we all behave and think. And it was such a popular podcast, that one. If you're listening to this and you haven't listened to it, I'd listen back to it, because we'll cover a bit of it in this, but it is amazing. What makes you want to look at humans and the way we are?
That's a really good question. I think it's got kind of two parts to it. One part is I grew up in quite a strict Catholic household with strict Catholic parents, really old school, kind of Catholicism school. You know, I was an altar boy in Catholic school and all that stuff. And I never believed it. Like even from a kid, I just never believed a word of it. And, I think it was just that sense of all the adults around me who were these like smart people. And they believed in this stuff that I just thought, this is the same stuff I'm reading in my children's books, my Roald Dahl books. It's like fantasy. Like I couldn't get my head around it. So I think it's that, you know, going to a Catholic school and pushing against that and getting in trouble a lot for being angry about, I'm surrounded by mad people. So I think that's it too. And I think the other side of that question is, probably a negative thing really, is just that kind of frustration with people, with people. The more kind of research I've done and the more you see, about kind of how people behave in the world, I just feel like if there's kind of one problem that we have as a species, it's this enormous hubris. You know, we think, one of the quotes in Selfie that I found, this kind of genius from the early days of Silicon Valley said, we are all as gods. It's like, no, like we're not. We're really not. We're animals, you know. We're these weird animals that have learned how to have kind of culture, and we're massively flawed. And one of the massive flaws that we've got is this idea that we are like gods, and so you get these kind of people who live lives of absolute certainty about who they are, about what's true and what's not true. And I guess I experienced that growing up in that Catholic household. And it hasn't ended. You kind of think as you get older, you're going to, it will kind of chill out a bit, that's still the world that we live in.
There's this thing, because there's this big movement at the moment, which we might touch on later, but for everyone to be equal, it's a great theory. We'd love it all to be equal. And I always quote this guy, who's an astronaut, and I interviewed, and I have, God, Jesus Christ, his name escapes me now. what an idiot I am. But anyway, he told me that when he went up into space, I've said this so many times on the podcast, so sorry to bore people, but it's such a poignant thing. When you go up, you think you're going to look out at, you know, at Jupiter and all the galaxy. You actually don't. You spend all your time looking back on Earth. And you look back and you look back and you see this beautiful green and blue planet. And it's the most beautiful planet in the solar system, the most beautiful planet we've ever seen, isn't it? It's so amazing. And it's in the Goldilocks zone, and it's inhabited by humans, you know, top of the pyramid. And you think, why can't we all get on? And then you come back as an astronaut and you think, I've got to spread the message of hope and, you know, what a beautiful thing and why we all can't get on it. It's all our planet. We should all look at it. And then as soon as you get in a car and go on the motorway, you get cut up by someone and you're straight back to, you fucking idiot, you did it. And then you realize that it's just hard because not everybody is, no one's, to use a horrible word, no one's singing from the, we're not all singing from the same hymn sheet. You know, we're all thinking different things. We've all been brought up in different ways. And that's why your book, Selfie, was so good, because we are malleable, aren't we? We can change, and we have been changed by religion or where you are, your geography. So there's so many different views and inputs into a human. And I'm starting to believe, Will, that we're more machines than we are, you know, free will. I'm starting to believe that's all we are. We've just been programmed by parents, society, peer groups, television, music, whatever. And then we are the product of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the debate in the sciences. I mean, you know, one of the things, I don't have a scientific background, but I've been writing about this stuff for about 10 years now. And one of the things that sort of blew my head off when I first started looking into it was that the debate in neuroscience and psychology isn't do we have free will or don't we have free will. It is between do we not have any free will at all and we're just zombies and free will is just this illusion, this story, or do we have a tiny marginal version of free will, which sometimes they call free won't, which means that if we're about to just do something really stupid, because we can just stop ourselves at the last minute. So that's the mainstream debate in science. It isn't, are we these free things? It's are we complete zombies or just mostly zombies? So that view, it sounds crazy, but that's the mainstream view in the sciences.
Yeah, well, I've listened to a few podcasts where they've discussed that in the future, no one might be guilty of a crime, because they can just trace the person back through their past and the influences that parents have had on them or society in general, and that they've been created into whatever crime they've committed. And it's, you know, we shouldn't really be locking anyone away. We should just be trying to reprogram the human. And I mean, it's moving that way because I think a lot of us believe how do you say that word?
Rehabilitation,
that's the word, sorry, is probably better than just pure punishment, you know?
I've got a lot of sympathy for that argument. I've got loads of sympathy for that argument because, you know, I really do think that we are mostly not free will, and, you know, we just are who we are, and, you know, we're a lot of genes, and we're a little bit of upbringing and a little bit of experience. But by the time we get into our early 20s, you know, we really are who we are. Our brains are finished sort of being built. And, you know, I often say to my wife, I just thank God, you know, I've got a temper like a lot of men, but I'm not violent. You know, I've never hit anyone or anything like that. And for me, I just count that as one of the blessings. Like, thank God I'm not violent. And, you know, when in my journalistic career, when I've interviewed, you know, murderers and people like this, who've got themselves in real trouble. And it is that kind of there, but for the grace of God go I, you know, like I really do think that. But then on the other hand of the scale is that you know, so rehabilitating people, trying to treat people and make them better, I think is a great idea. But we've evolved to be these kind of creatures that have kind of lived in these kind of punishing environments whereby, you know, we don't have, even if we had no free will at all, our behavior is still modulated by stuff. And some of that stuff is fear. It's fear of the group, you know, seeking retribution on us. So I don't know how much taking that away would, I don't know. I mean, it would be a really fascinating experiment to have. You know, would we still be good? Are we so kind of genetically kind of pre-programmed? Are we so kind of fixed that we'd still be good without that, with pure conscience?
Yeah. I went to a wedding, by the way, and my friend Chris's wedding, and I got talking to a pathologist there, and I said, tell me something that you know that I don't know. I like doing that when I meet people who've got an expertise in something. And he said, everyone has it in them to kill or murder. And I went, no, I don't. And he went, no, you do. That's what I know now. If you push enough buttons, you've got the ability to do it. Hey, an animal's arrived.
Yeah, sorry, Jonesy, come on. I'm kind of busy, mate.
So let's get into this then, the way that I feel, and I spoke to you and I said, you fancy doing a podcast about this, because I think you have an understanding of humans more than a lot of people I know, because you've written so much about it, and also you've got to, you know, you've looked in it different ways as well. So I've got to say, though, to begin with, I do understand that I'm privileged. I've got a job and I've got a house and I've got a small garden and I've got a bit of money, so I'm getting paid. So I understand that I'm better off than a lot of people. And that makes me feel terrible, by the way, that I'm not enjoying this experience. I was okay for the first 2 months of this experience when I was told that if you leave the house, you're going to die, or if you're not going to die, you're going to kill our grandparents. I was okay with that structure. And I think a lot of people have told me on social media that they were too, that it was when we were told these were the rules, these were the laws, I think it was okay. But what I found is since we've started loosening up lockdown, it's become increasingly difficult for me. I struggle with the idea that I'm queuing for food all the time. The lack of contact has been horrific. I don't feel I belong to anything at the moment. I don't know what's going on. The news is very dark out there, and social media has gone crazy. I think it's really sent people. I don't seem to be able to find any facts and figures on suicide rates or anything. And there seems to be a lot of people saying attempted suicide has gone up. But then a lot of people are saying, no, it's just a myth. Where are you getting that facts from? So there's a lot of discussion on this at the moment, but it does seem to me that when I put it out there, I had a massive response on social media with people saying, Tim, I'm struggling too. And yeah, I'm at home with a family, or I'm at home with this. And as it seems to be a lot of people who seem to be very lonely. And that seems to be one of the big things as humans. I don't think we're supposed to be sitting on our own in four walls and just going for a walk. I think we're supposed to be mixing and communicating with people. What's your take on it so far?
Yeah, so one of the kind of smartest things I've ever read about being human, about asking that question, what is it to be human? Is this idea that humans are driven by two needs, separate, they're kind of connected but separate as well. We need to get along with people and get ahead of them as well. So we have to kind of feel connected into groups, because we're an ape. You know, we're a species of ape, and like all ape, we evolved in troops and then we became tribal. You know, we existed in tribes. We kind of came down from the trees, and we kind of gathered around campsites. We existed in tribes. So we have to feel connected. And, you know, that's a very deep kind of pre-programmed thing, because back when our brains were evolving, if we felt disconnected from people, that was a signal that things were going very badly wrong. Because if you felt disconnected from people, it would be a sign that you're going to be kicked out of your tribe. And that's a death sentence. And that would have been a death sentence for tribal members who are kind of acting out and being selfish and being aggressive or whatever, you know, breaking one of the rules of the tribe. You know, there are various punishments. The one before execution is ostracization. You're kicked out of the tribe. And the one after that, obviously, is execution. So we have a very deep, we have a very deep need to connect with other people. And when we're feeling disconnected, it's a kind of profound fear. It's very deep in our kind of pre-programming. So that's connection. And then there's also, we need to sort of get ahead of other people. It's no good for us to feel like we're connected into our tribe, but we're kind of useless. We're kind of like we're kind of like being carried. Everybody kind of wants to feel like they're important, they're of value. And that's really important. And of course, that's what we spend most of our lives doing. Now we've got this developed kind of settled world, which is kind of technologically advanced. And most of us, thank God, not all of us, but most of us in the West are not literally struggling to survive every day. What do we spend our time doing? We spend our time earning status and getting validation from people, making ourselves feel important and displaying our importance in terms of achievements in football or podcasting or writing or whatever it is that we're doing. So those are two very profound needs. They're fundamental needs. They're universal needs. They're pre-baked into us. They're wired into us. They're in our DNA. So I think that's why lockdown is so very challenging, because it's removing connection from us for a start, obviously, you know, almost completely, apart from these kind of Zoom conversations. And for a lot of people, especially the furloughed people, maybe a lot of them are kind of enjoying kicking back a little bit, but that status making, you know, all of us need to have it. But of course there's variations. Some people really need it and some people need it less. So that's why, I think those that, you know, so lockdown kind of assaults those two kind of very human needs.
Yeah, hindsight's always a wonderful thing when it comes to something like this. But I wonder, I've been interested in the Sweden's take on this virus, and they seem to be saying constantly that we need to be living with it and surviving with it rather than sort of pulling away from it. And they've taken a lot of criticism for that. Yet South Korea have done the same thing. They've never shut up, have they? They've decided to live with it, but obviously protect the elderly and the vulnerable. And it seems to have worked there, not quite so well in Sweden. But Sweden seemed to think that, if you listen to the guy, he seems to think it's important to keep society going, to keep the economy going, to do these things. And I assume what he means is, carry on being human. Let's as many of us be carry on being human as possible, whereas we just shut down totally. So as I say, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a wonderful thing, and I do feel, again, I think it's one of the things about getting older. You realise, hang on, the people in charge are kind of about my age now. So they're not these kind of superhero gods that you kind of. You demand that they are, especially when you're younger, and I feel far less ready to judge on these things, especially having been a journalist for so long. You know, one of the things about being a journalist is it teaches a lot of kind of measure of humility, because you realize you go into these stories as a journalist thinking you know it all, because you've read some stuff on Twitter and you've read some headlines. And then when you interview the experts, you realize that you're wrong about 99% of the stuff that you're wrong about. And you spend, you know, sometimes weeks, sometimes months researching a subject. And even when you're writing up, you're thinking, oh my God, I hope I've got this right, you know. So I think that's one of the things when we're kind of arguing about lockdown and arguing about these kind of very complex matters, that they're way more complex than we know. And the meetings that every government's going to be having are going to be really complex and really a menu of unbelievably complicated decisions to choose from, all with horrific ramifications. So, you know, it's kind of fun to kind of kick off and argue and debate about it. But again, it's that, as you say, hindsight's really easy, isn't it? But you have to hold your leaders to account. You know, that's part of what we have to do as a populace. And you know, a certain amount of that kind of scolding and judging is important. Otherwise, they're not held to account. But equally, I think as well that there's that you have to also have that idea of these aren't gods. You know, they're just people in a really horrible situation trying to navigate us through an unprecedented, you know, literally unprecedented scenario.
Yeah, I wonder what the media's role in all this is. As I stated a little bit before, it's very dark when you turn on the news. Media's changed dramatically. I wonder if media has changed, because they always wanted to sell newspapers years ago. Now it's getting clicks online or getting ratings on TV more. It seems that everything that happens now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of nuance. Maybe there never was. It seems to be pick a side. What side are you on? Is Dominic Cummings a terrible person, or should we let him off? What side are you on? And you know, pick a side and go for it, rather than can we talk a bit more about it? You know, see what's actually happening, and you know, can we find? I mean, I've always thought with the Dominic Cummings thing, we need to find out how important he is in his role. We never got to that. We never found that out, because obviously they were. But we need to know why Boris Johnson wants to keep him so badly when other people can just be sacrificed. We need to know that, I think, as people. Yeah. But anyway, let's get away from that. I mean, it's the media has quite an interesting role in this, doesn't it? Because it's become quite sensationalist, whichever medium you're looking at.
Yeah. Well, the media does have a role, and again, you can go back to our evolution to find out what that role is. And one of the really, for me, surprising things about the kind of groups that we evolved in, because it's so counterintuitive compared to the life after day, is that our tribes were essentially leaderless. So you'd have these kind of local experts, somebody who was the best hunter, somebody was the best gatherer of berries, somebody was the best sorcerer, who would step up and advise on those particular issues. You'd have kind of elders that would have had a limited amount of power. But really the big decisions, especially the big decisions on who to kind of punish, would be taken by the group. And what you'd get is these kind of lines of gossip and accusation against somebody, kind of building up and building up and building up and building up. And the purpose of gossip and accusation is to build consensus. And then once there's a consensus reached, then that person is punished. And so what the role that the media plays is to be the gossip, the tribal gossip network.
Wow.
But rather than for 150 people, but for literally millions of people. So that's what it's doing. So this idea that we have, so there's an ideal of what the media should be. And what the media should do is give us the truth. Because what it's doing in to our unconscious minds is trying to build consensus for punishment. That's its role. But of course, that's not what obviously happens, because we're tribal and because that's why we gossip. That's why we swap these stories. I mean, the media's, you know, hunter-gatherer gossip networks are obsessed with one kind of gossip, and it's usually high-status people doing selfish things. That's exactly what modern newspapers and kind of social media is full of. It's the same stuff, with the same beast that we were 10,000 years ago, or tens of thousands of years ago. We're the same animal. We have the same brains. So that's why you see this kind of weird ideal of what the media should be, because we have to make these decisions wisely. So we need the truth, but actually, what the media is doing is fulfilling that need as our gossip network. So it very easily becomes. Especially in times of trouble, it very easily becomes kind of tight and aggressive and partisan and kind of angry and kind of, you know, because it's written by other humans who've got the same brains, you know. So it becomes kind of perverted. And as you said, you know, you kind of touched upon the other point that since the dawn of the internet, incentives have changed amongst journalists, you know, and I've lived through this, you know, I started as a journalist in 2002. So, you know, pre-internet, there was a strong incentive for journalists to discover the truth. So, you know, the era of Watergate, you know, so huge amounts of money would be invested on finding the truth and exposing the truth. And you'd get a reputation for being a truth teller, and you sell loads of newspapers, you get all this prestige. But that's out the window now, because nobody buys newspapers anymore, generally speaking. All the advertising is now with Facebook and Google, so there's no advertising money anymore. So as you said, you know, as I wrote about in Selfie, mostly what you have to do is get clicks. And how you get clicks is by conforming much more to that kind of nasty tribal version of a gossip network, which is, you know, when we hear gossip, we experience moral outrage, and it's that moral outrage that makes us kind of warps our thinking, makes us prejudiced and biased and horrible and aggressive, and builds that consensus to attack. And so it's moved much more in that direction, I now think, because it just wants you to click, 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 click. Yeah, and the best way to get you to click is to spread moral outrage.
Media's about being first, not the most accurate, isn't it, at the moment? Well,
not even first. I think a lot of it is about being kind of the most controversial, you know. Somebody has said something, someone's done something. What's the most vindictive and kind of hostile way that we can position this statement such that it's going to get us a million clicks? You know, like the stuff has been about Harry and his comments about the Commonwealth today. You know, I don't know anything. I didn't even know today before really what the Commonwealth was, like most people. You know, I'm no huge fan of Harry and Meghan, on the contrary. But, you know, reading the coverage today, a lot of it really was the journalists had gone out of their way to watch that video where he'd made the comments about the Commonwealth. What's the most controversial spin that we can take on what he said? He said the Commonwealth is racist. I don't think he said that. But that was heavily what was implied today, and that's good business. because it gets our tribal outrage circuits kind of pumping. It gets us angry, it gets us clicking, gets us commenting.
And I understand that negative news is more prevalent than positive news. Yeah. Reason being, it's for survival. The pessimist live, the optimist gets eaten by the crocodile. You know, that's kind of the way you survive, is by trying to take on the bad news to make sure that you don't end up in that place.
That's absolutely right. And again, it's about tribal gossip networks. When you look at tribal gossip, most of it is about infractions, because it's valuable for us to find out who, you know, when you're a hunter-gatherer tribe without a town or a city or a police force, it's just you guys, you know, with another tribe over there who might want to kill you, and a bunch of, you know, animals over there that want to kill you, and you're running out of food, and it's and it looks like there's a famine on the way. It's really important to find out who's pulling with the team and who's working against it. That is really important. So that's why we gossiped. It's really mostly about, partly it's about celebrating heroes and incentivizing heroic acts, but mostly it's about enforcement. It's about making sure that people stick to the rules, because we're human beings. We don't really often want to put the group before our own interests. We want to put our own interests first. So you have to have a very powerful, the prison system. You have to have very powerful punishments in place, or threats in place, in order to kind of almost coerce people into behaving virtuously. And, you know, and you say there is the other side where we celebrate heroes. That's the other side of the story. And that's the other, is a carrot and stick. That's the other right way we like to do good kind of selfless things, is because we get all this virtuous status. You know, we feel like we're, you know, Mother Teresa.
So I suppose it's really stressful for us at the moment, because there's a million ways you can, even if you put on your phone these days, the first page which comes up is the news. And then every social media, it's just, you know, filtered an abundance of news on there, and opinions, and it's a lot of opinions on there. And as soon as you turn the TV on and the radio and everywhere, it's coming at you left, right, and center. And I suppose in a pandemic situation that we're in at the moment, it can become quite stressful, because what you really want is one very clear message and one very clear leadership. I'm not here to be political about Boris Johnson, but I feel that I've run out. I've lost any idea of what a bubble is, or, I mean, I kind of stopped listening to all that a long time ago. Yeah. It's just like, I think like everybody, we were like, oh, hold on, I just don't know what's going on. And you tend to go to the high street or to the tube station or whatever, and just try and follow everyone else, because you think they probably know.
Yes.
Whereas you listen to, you know, the guy from Sweden, or Angela Merkel, or Jacinda down in New Zealand, they seem to be really, you know, they seem to send proper messages out. This is what's happening. Simplistic. Yeah. This is what we're doing, and this is how we're going to get through this. Yeah. I think we might be missing a bit of that as well. I think that might be playing havoc with my mind.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's obviously, people want certainty, and especially in times of trouble, in times of threat, you want certainty. And I think that's very true. And even if it turns out to be the wrong advice, there's still something very reassuring about having that leadership, where it's, this is what we're doing, A, B, C, do it, and we're going to be okay. And, you know, I think there's something very reassuring about that.
One of my favorite books of your book, Selfie, which sort of changed my mind on a lot of things, was how different we are in different parts of the world. A good point you make is Asia versus Europe. How they for the better good, we're very individual and they're very group thinking. And so this has been interesting during a pandemic, because when they close down in China, everyone just does it, don't they? You said earlier, you know, people want to criticize the leadership. You don't tend to do that in China.
No, not in China,
it doesn't have very good consequences. But even if you look in South Korea, which is a much more sort of, actually, you talk about South Korea quite a lot in your book, because it's kind of an Eastern concept with lots of Western influences coming through. But they've all decided to toe the line of what they're going to do, and they've managed to get. I mean, they've been one of the success stories of the pandemic, haven't they, over there?
Yeah, they have, and again, it's one of those things that even if you wanted to copy them in the West, you couldn't, because we're different kinds of people. We have different cultural programming. You know, as you say, in the West, we're individualistic. You know, we see the individual as the most important kind of unit, and the group secondary. At least that's how we've been thinking for a few centuries. Whereas in the East, it's much more, it's the group first. You know, there was a study I was reading about the other day where 80% of respondents in a survey in China agreed that the government should manage the internet. I mean, you just wouldn't get that here. Be like, no, you know, it would be 8% or something. I read another thing that Asian kind of collectivist cultures are better at getting climbers to the top of Everest, but they also kill more people in the process. Right. So it's much more about the group. It's much more about, we're going to do it. It's like a tighter culture, much more conformist. And there are good things about that, and there are bad things about that.
Yeah. Last time I interviewed you, I said, what's the best way? And you laughed and went, yeah, you can tell where you're from by even asking the question.
Yeah, that's it. They don't think there's a best. Yeah. So in the West, we're very good or bad at this idea that the truth is this quality that exists in the world. It's something you can dig out of the ground. And we want to find the truth. What is the truth? And whereas in the East, it's much more about this idea in the West, we kind of have oppositional fights to get to the truth. We have done since ancient Greece. Mm. But in the East, it's much more about achieving conformity. Well, there's this opinion and there's that opinion, and we've just got to work together. And just as long as the group's got to achieve harmony. It's about the achievement of harmony. So it's their culture is much more about trying to have conflicting forces kind of coexist and go in the right one direction, rather than us who just want to scrap it out and we value, have different opinions. Although, of course, that is changing a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like a bit of a spoiled brat, actually, because I was discussing with my friends the other day, going, God, I'm so miserable. Look at me. All I do is get up and I go shopping. And it's like, I've got to realize the idea that a lot of the world still doesn't have passports. They can't just do what I want to do, which is hop on a plane somewhere to escape my life at the moment, because I'm a bit bored. And I can't just go, they can't just go, right, well, I'm going to go out to a restaurant, because they don't have the finances to do that. And they do get up every day and just have a very similar life.
Yeah.
We've become quite strange in Britain and a lot of Europe and places like America and Australia and stuff like that, where we don't want routine so much. We love a routine, but we want to be able to do what we want, when we want. We're free. We can do whatever. That must be a pretty modern thing. I can't imagine that being the way in this country in the 20s.
Yeah, that's true. But again, again, it's that understanding that, we're a product of our time and place. So they didn't have foreign holidays. I mean, we're one of the first generations ever that people of any kind of pretty much any social class can have foreign holidays, and apart from people right at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale. But that doesn't mean we're happier than people who lived 100, 200 years ago. So this idea that happiness and kind of your kind of ability to spend money are connected is just not true. It just doesn't exist. That's just not how it works. We're born into a particular world in a particular time and place with a particular level of socioeconomic, status, and we get used to that, and that's just the norm. And if we fall below that, we're miserable. And if we climb above that, we start getting really happy. And that's the same no matter kind of where you start out. Of course, there's a bottom to that logic, where people are so poorly off that they can't afford to get healthcare, and these people, there is that difference. But there was a study done of the national mood in Britain, and apparently we were happiest, I forget the exact year, but we were happiest as a nation in around the kind of late 1700s, early 1800s, I think that was it. So we're less happy now than we were then, but we're much, much more wealthy now than we were then. So that was an analysis of the national mood done in sort of millions and millions of newspaper reports going back hundreds of years. And that happened to be when we were at the height of empire. So, the Britain status was just this enormous, everybody was very proud of, this thing that we're now deeply ashamed of for lots of good reasons. This idea that happiness and wealth is, ability to go on an easy jet are kind of connected is just not true. And if it was true, you'd get this predictable gradation of happiness, and people would be most miserable in the poorest places in the world and happiest in like Monaco, that isn't true. Yeah. That's not what you find when you travel the world at all. You find, you know, it's not really a sound idea. It's perfectly possible, as you, I'm sure, know, to be Tim Lovejoy, and with all the amazing thing being Tim Lovejoy brings, and to be miserable, perhaps even suicidal. You know, rich people kill themselves all the time, and it's not because they're silly, and it's not because they're ungrateful. It's because they're unhappy. You know, and their unhappiness is as valid as the unhappiness of anybody else in the world, as far as I'm
concerned. Yeah, as regular listeners will know to this podcast, I've had mental health issues. It's interesting, when I was trying to research on suicide during the lockdown, a lot of people who've actually, Alistair Campbell did a video on Twitter. I texted him to say, mate, I hope you're all right, because he said he's written a book on how to get over depression. Then he ended up in depression, and there's a lot of people online saying, I sort of got over my depression, I've got over my mental health issues, but they've all come back. Yeah. Because we've been transported into this very strange world, and yeah, and it doesn't feel comfortable for a lot of us. That's how I describe it. I don't feel very comfortable when I wake up. I'm a bit like looking around going, oh, what's happened? And I think we might have to adjust, and it's taking me quite a long time to adjust. Just going back to something you were saying a minute ago, I read a book called The Choice Paradox, and you know, with more money comes more choice, and apparently choice does not make us happy. In fact, it's completely the opposite. I can just sum up the book for you, so you don't have to read it, everyone, but basically the more choice you have, the more unhappy you'll be. If you have five choices of things, the least, if you're just choosing between two things, it's probably going to make you happier. And when you go for the choice, don't ever go for the best, because you'll always be wondering if you actually got the best. Just go for the adequate, and you'll be all right.
The adequate life.
Yeah, and do you know, I spoke to someone about this who is involved in marketing, and they say what they do, which is great, they say they're doing a new form of I don't know, toaster. They'll do a cheap one, they'll do a mid-range one, which they want everyone to buy, and then they'll do a ridiculously expensive one, which no one will buy, but everyone wants the ridiculously expensive one. And what they do is they think, I can't quite afford that one, so I'll go for the mid-range one. They make lots of mid-range ones because people don't buy the expensive one, and they don't really want the cheap one. So
I think I read the same thing about wine on restaurant menus, that they deliberately put a silly, silly expensive one on there, because they know that what most people are going to do is look at that and go, oh no, and then go for the and then it just, that is such a, that I could just imagine that working. Like, that is what you do. Like, if there's one silly expensive one and the next one down was quite a lot cheaper, but still more than you were expecting, you're going to go for that one.
Simon Rimmer, the chef on, my co-presenter on Sunday Brunch, owns lots of restaurants. He always says, always go for, if you're in a decent restaurant, always go for the house, because restaurants are judged on their house wines. Oh, wow. So they'll always put a really good, reasonably priced house wine on. And so, because that's a lot of the time how they're judged. It doesn't work so much with chains, but it works in a half decent restaurant. So they always want to put a half decent one on there because they're judged on that. Let's talk about The Science of Storytelling, another book that you've written. How does that equate to being a human and how we're feeling?
Well, I think quite it's quite central, really. The idea of the science of storytelling, really, it's a kind of summation of all the stuff that was in Selfie and the book before that, The Heretics. I've kind of brought it together because both of those books were basically investigating the idea that we are a story, and the reasons that we tell stories and the ways that we tell stories is not because storytellers have invented this genius thing. It's because we're mimicking the way that we experience our daily life. You know, if you think about it, like, you know, the train's late, you're late for a meeting. Back in the days when we had meetings, you know, you flip into James Bond mode. It's like, you know, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, the world narrows and you're this kind of adventure hero on this very mediocre, you know, story, trying to get to a meeting on time. You know, that's how, you know, when crisis hits, we kind of flip into that story mode. So that's really what the book is. It's a book about how we are, about how we are stories, really. You know, we are the stories of our lives. We are the things that we're doing. We are the kind of plots, the goals that we're pursuing, and that's really who we are. And again, I think that's why lockdown is so difficult, because it's that kind of interruption of the story. You know, we can't really be out there, you know, fighting our monsters.
Yeah,
we're stuck inside, you know, with the wrong kinds of monsters.
Do you think it's stories we're telling ourselves or other people are telling us? What's more important? Because obviously there's a narrative where we're being told a lot of things at the moment. You know, it's moving very quickly in our society of how, you know, you mentioned it earlier, some of the atrocities that we have as a nation committed. We've been told these stories about ourselves all the time. But is it that, or is it stories we tell ourselves when we wake up in the morning?
Well, that's a good question. I guess those two things are in conflict quite often. The brain creates this kind of illusion. Well, there's a neuroscientist, very famous neuroscientist called Chris Frith. And Chris Frith says the brain's job is to make us feel like we're the invisible actor at the center of the world, which is such a great line. And that's what it does. We feel like we're this invisible actor at the center of the world. The whole universe happens around us. And that kind of character of us, that kind of heroic character of us, and if we're psychologically healthy, it is heroic. If you think about when you're depressed and perhaps even suicidal, part of that is those storytelling capacities failing. You don't feel like a hero that can go out there and conquer the world. You feel like the world is overwhelming, that you're useless, and you just want to get into the back of the cave. So that kind of story breaks down, that heroic sense of yourself kind of breaks down. And who you kind of particularly are is a combination of your genes. You know, it's a lot of who we are is genetic, builds our personality. And of course, we're born into a particular culture with particular values, into a particular family. We join particular peer groups around the age 14 that continue kind of to shape us. So that's kind of who we are. And then, of course, you describe the experience of being kind of bombarded by stories from the news, from culture, political stories. And I suppose our ability and kind of willingness to kind of accept them, reject them, kind of process them rationally, a lot of that depends on who we are and those kind of values that we've kind of absorbed as we've grown up. I think one of the tricks of the brain is it always wants to make us feel heroic, right? Again, with the big caveat, if we're mentally healthy, it's always trying to make us feel heroic. So it has all these different biases and little tricks to make that makes it very easy to dismiss the evidence of our enemies, the people who make us feel not heroic. We're very good at dismissing their arguments. We've got all these different tricks. We do things like finding the weakest part of their argument and then using that to go, oh, they're an idiot, obviously. that's one of the things that we do. Or, you know, studies have even shown that we literally forget. Like, if we hear a really powerful argument that we're wrong, we're very good at just forgetting it. And then, you know, we just can't remember it anymore. There are even studies that have shown recently that we actually find it much harder to logic about kind of data that contradicts our beliefs. So our brain kind of finds it difficult to even process facts that run counter to our beliefs. But the biggest bias, the strongest bias, they think, is the moral bias. So for some reason, it's very, very, very important to your brain and the brains of everybody who's kind of watching and listening to this, that we feel morally good, that we feel like a good person. So the general story that we're told is, yes, I've made mistakes, I'm not perfect, I'm no angel, but ultimately I'm a good person. And everybody thinks that, unless they're a psychopath or a sociopath. Pretty much everybody thinks that. And these British psychologists in 2014 actually tested that in a prison. They went into a prison and they asked actual prisoners in actual prison about their kind of biases. You know, what do you think, you're most moral than most people? And they thought they were most moral than most people. They were more selfless than most people. And the only thing that they weren't more than most people was law abiding. And they rated themselves as average. So they're in prison. And they rated themselves as average on law-abidingness, and they still rated themselves as more moral than most people. So that's how powerful that kind of bias is.
We touched last time we spoke about last time we did a podcast together. We touched on the rise of the narcissist because the self-esteem movement, which you discussed with Thatcher and Reagan in the 80s, mm-hmm. which became prevalent, and everybody thinking they were amazing and wonderful, sometimes can create a lot of narcissism and. Do narcissistic people, they must be deeply unhappy because they can struggle with their morals a lot, can't they? I mean,
I think narcissistic people are even better than most of us at thinking that they're good people. there's a myth about narcissism. So the self-esteem 1980s myth about narcissism, which people still mostly believe very commonly, is the thing about narcissists is they secretly hate themselves. They're just covering up for this secret self-hatred. Right. That's literally not true. They think they're amazing. They think they're brilliant. They think they're fantastic. That's why they're narcissists. So they're very, very good at, you know, they're better than the most of us at remixing the world such that they're the heroes and they're fantastic and they're wonderful. So I think the narcissist might be struggling in lockdown because they love attention and they love, you know, the acclaim of other people. So not being able to have that in the real world might be difficult, but I'm sure they're all over social media, these people. My prediction, they wouldn't be struggling with any kind of creaking self-image, unless they've like put on loads of weight or something like I have.
Oh, so I'm wondering, going around sort of like a full circle, then it's, if we're the heroes in our story, when Boris Johnson comes on and he goes, you know, a lot of you are going to die, and, you know, or people are going to die, and we're going to do this, and we're going to, you know, shut up shop, and then we're going to have a lockdown, and we all sit and go, we're doing our bit. Yeah, we're doing our bit. We're all locked down, and we're going to queue up. We're going to get people delivering stuff to our houses. We're all doing our bit. 2 months later, when it is all the stats are looking a bit weird, and they're going, you know, I mean, I feel really sorry for young people in this. We're asking a lot of them, and I've said this, and it's not probably the best thing for me to say, but we're all in this together is a fantastic catchphrase. I mean, that you get a movement going these days with catchphrases, you know, make America great again. Yes, we can, or whatever, you know, take back control. But we're all in this together was an amazing catchphrase for us during this time. And everybody was doing that. But we're asking young people to be all in this together, where they know they're not actually at as much risk as old people, especially yes. especially the people in their teens and 20s and obviously yeah. younger than that, who want to go out. And also, they're watching the economy and their society breaking down, and the idea that they can't go to university, they don't go to school, there's going to be no work for them, we're going to be in massive recession. And how long does we're all in this together last for? Does it go to the fact that when we're out of it, we're all going to remortgage our house to put it back in because we're all in it together? Or are we going to go, thanks everyone for staying at home now. We're getting back on with our lives.
Yeah, well, I think the depressing answer to that is that we're all in this together does work. There is an effect of that. And you find that again in studies that look, you know, it's that blitz spirit idea that when disaster strikes, we tighten up, we become more conformist, we look after each other more, and we become more selfless with our own people, we look out for each other more. And there was one study, a very interesting study of combat veterans in World War II that found that even 40 years later, the ones that had served together in the same unit still maintained very tight social bonds. And the more deaths they'd experienced together in the combat zone, the tighter their bonds remained 40 years later. So we're on it together really works. And again, it goes back to that tribal coding. You know, when the tribe's under attack, we bond, you know, we coordinate much better. We become almost like we gel together almost as an organism. But that that requires genuine pressure, right? So I think what happens with lockdown is that when in the beginning it was terrifying. What is this bloody thing? Oh my God, it's this thing that's come from Wuhan. What is it? And how many people are going to die? Is it going to be like the Black Death? And it's the novelty of seeing those empty streets and people talking about zombie movies. And then once that novelty wears off, and you know, the horror, it really is a number on the newspaper. This is that many deaths. And I just feel like the kind of slightly depressing answer is that in order to, especially in an individualist culture like ours, in order to keep that extreme level of conformity, would take real horror over a long period of time. You know, we're not being bombed by the Nazis. This is kind of a kind of disaster that for the vast majority of us, we're experiencing on a screen. You know, so it kind of, and you know, most people don't. I mean, you know, so I think that's part of the thing. Is that after a while, it's just like
I found the war. The war sort of total constant. We're at war. we're fighting it. I found that problematic because I can't fight a virus. Yeah. Doesn't matter how many bench presses I do or how many martial arts classes I take or how many guns I buy. That thing, I can't kill another human to save my children. It's a virus. And I found it problematic all the way through because we weren't surviving bombs, as you're right. I was just like, I don't feel like I'm at war. I'm sat at home and I feel like it's a virus. And yeah. I feel like I can get it through touching the wrong thing. And
I think there's a good psychological argument for me. I don't know why they made that thing, but I think there's a very good psychological argument for doing that. And that's just because subconsciously, when we feel that we're at war, we go into that tighter, more conformist state. And it did work. You know, when you go out there, people do try and maintain social distances and you get tutted at loudly in Marks and Spencers if you break it. People are wearing the mask. People are kind of washing their hands. So you see, you know, it's been really interesting to see over the last few months just how good we are at conforming. And that is the vast majority of us, at least in my experience, where, you know, I've been shopping and stuff. People have been very do good and policing each other as well. And a lot of that comes from that we're at war. And so, you know, you can't go and do bench presses and kill people. What you can do is wash your hands for 20 seconds and that's what people have been doing. So it might be irritating, but I would argue that there's a good psychological reason for pushing that. But then, as you just said, you can't maintain it. You can't sustain it for that long.
Yeah, I think that's
just sort of war where you just got to stand apart from each other.
Yeah, I suppose we're coming back round to where we were at the beginning, which is it was fine when we were all locked down and it was like wash your hands and stay away from everyone. Now it's all slowly we're coming back to normal, but the virus hasn't waved a white flag. It hasn't signed a treaty saying, you know, whatever. It's done nothing. It's still here and we're having to step back out again. I think that is where a lot of us are struggling with, because we don't know the direction we're going and we don't know what we're supposed to be really doing. We're not sure what story we're supposed to be telling ourselves. Yeah. One minute I'm reading, because in a minute I read, obviously we're just absolutely, my children are 18, by the way. They're going off to university. They talk to me about American news. Their politics, like it's in Britain. I keep going, it's in America. And it's like, it's become so influential what's happening in America. So I've even found myself doing it, listening to them talk about masks. They're very strong on masks in America. Right. They want masks and they want people to wear them and they're getting angry with it. Over here, we're not. So we don't even know whether we're supposed to be wearing a mask unless you're going on the tube where you do. We don't know where else we're supposed to be wearing a mask. So I think this is where the fundamental problem is. I don't know what stories we're telling ourselves, to go back to the storytelling thing. I don't know how to be a hero, what to do, where I'm going, what's the latest.
I think that's right. And I think it goes back to that, you know, at the end of the day, especially in a period of crisis, we want firm instructions. You know, I remember back in the, you know, when I used to work in an office and I had good bosses and I had bad bosses. And the bad bosses weren't necessarily ones that made bad decisions. The bad bosses were ones that wouldn't make any decisions. And you just didn't know what the fuck was going on. And they would just change their mind all the time. The good bosses, they often made mistakes, but you knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
You knew where you stood. And I think that's true of all kind of leadership, really. You can forgive a leader making mistakes. At least I think you should every now and again. But I think leadership breaks down not when it makes a mistake. It breaks down when it stops leading and saying, this is my decision. This is what you need to do.
Yeah. So I suppose the conclusion to this conversation is that I blame Boris Johnson. It is sort of true. When he started doing the traffic light thing and stuff, I was like, all right, I get it. Right, we're gonna go. I haven't seen the traffic light since then, have you? It's like, if you're going to go with something, and the R rates, I get the R rates, but why don't they publish them every single day so we know what direction we're going? And just tell us what their plan is. But I'm under suspicion that they don't have a plan. That's the problem.
They've got too many plans. They've probably got 18 plans and 18 people canvassing in their meetings for different plans. And they're just like frozen. It's that horror of choice that you were talking about. You know,
the choice paradox. Yeah.
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 Well, listen, thank you so much for this conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Both your books are still available now, aren't they? Selfie and the Science of Storytelling. Yeah. And, what's your other one you did? You Selfie. Just meant that. Pardon? Selfie, and Heretics. Yes.
Heretics, so, yeah,
So yeah. All great reads. I mean, I tell everyone to buy Selfie and read it, because I think it's so important to where we are at the moment in the world. I think it's a really interesting, and see, I think you could do, you know, even more follow up to that sort of thing. It seems to be moving very rapidly at the moment, the world, the future.
Yes, well, that's the next book. So I'm writing about now, and by the time it's published next year, hopefully we'll be two out of date.
All right, brilliant. Well, hopefully we can have another chat on the podcast. It's always a pleasure talking to you. If people want to follow you, where's the best place? Are you doing much social media?
Twitter is at WStore, STORR. I just use it for kind of updates about books and stuff.
Perfect. Are you doing any social media stuff at the moment?
No, I'm way off social media. It's too dangerous place at the moment.
I'm finding that. I'm wondering whether I should just switch it off, because I just think I may be reading too much of it at the moment. I think maybe I'm taking in too many stories, as you're saying. And I suppose if I'm taking in too much, it's probably making me a bit dark.
Yeah, I think, well, I actually ditched my smartphone just before lockdown in February, because I had the same experience. It was making me dark. It's making me angry. It's making me very political. I don't really want to be very political. So I got rid of my smartphone, and I've got to say, it's one of those decisions that as soon as I made it, everything became better. I don't miss it at all. And the main thing is not having a smartphone in the house. You don't need a smartphone in your house, but yet everywhere, in telly, in the kitchen, in my office, constant on Twitter, constant on the news. And it's so nice not having that. And the thing is, you don't miss it. It's not even annoying. I still have a smartphone for when I go out to meetings and stuff, because you need it. But it's in the drawer, and I've got like another phone to use. So I really do recommend.
Well, so you have two numbers then?
I've got two numbers. Yeah. So my smartphone I just use for email, you know, for digital stuff. No, I mean, I don't even use that number. I just use it when I go out. My smartphone's in my pocket, and I've got email maps to go to the meeting. But that only comes out with me when I'm going out. Other time, it's called a light phone, and it's just a little. It's like a tiny little Kindle. And it has no social media, no internet on it.
I'm so jealous of you. I've bored my listeners here with the fact that I'm so addicted to my phone. I keep giving it up and I keep getting back on it. And especially when I had my back operation, I became so addicted. It was ridiculous. And the same's happened in lockdown. I think you might have just opened up something else, which has happened to me. I've spent so much time just refreshing, refreshing, refreshing. And it's just, maybe it's driving me nuts. Maybe I need to stop that. I'm jealous. I went to do Virgin Radio when we had a cookbook out from my show, and Chris Evans was there, and then his PA guy said, oh yeah, Chris doesn't have a phone. I went, what, not a phone? He says, no, he doesn't have a phone at all, landline or anything. And I was like, oh my God, it just sounds like bliss.
That's like the ultimate status symbol these days. If you can not have a phone, no social media, you've succeeded, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the one that happens to me, they always go, you're on telly, aren't you? And I go, yeah, yeah. And they go, I don't have a telly. Everyone says that. It's like, what, really? I mean, I don't know why we're getting such good ratings. Apparently no one has a TV anymore. Will, thank you, sir. I don't want to take up any more of your time. It's brilliant. We'll do another podcast soon when your next book comes out. Thank you so much.
Cheers. See ya.
Cheers. Bye. Thank you. That was Will Storr. Always like talking to him. Smart man. His books are always brilliant. I recommend reading Selfie. A real interesting read, that, and you learn a lot about the world that we inhabit today. Thank you so much for Quikr for sponsoring this podcast. My Quikr tap does hot water, it does cold water, it does 100 degree boiling hot water, it does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling water. It is a real game changer in the kitchen. I absolutely love it. Thank you for them to sponsoring this, because it helps it keep going. Anyway, we'll be back soon. And I've got a podcast, really good one, about breathing, about the breath, and how important breathing properly is, breathing through your nose, all the health benefits, etc. So I'll see you very soon. For the time being, peace and love, Joy.